It's Wednesday, March the 31st, and you're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism here at the Hoover Institution. About this podcast, by the way, if my voice sounds familiar, I hope it does. That means you were listening to the Area 45 podcast that we did during the previous presidency. But after November, we came to the realization that we needed to rename it. I could not come up with any clever variation of 46 other than a Chicago Bears defense from years ago that probably very few of you might remember. So,
I tell you the guys in it.
That's my guest, who you're going to find out in a minute. So we came up with Matters of Policy and Politics. We're not the only Hoover podcast, by the way. There's Econ Talk with Russ Roberts, The Grumpy Economist with John Cochran, The Pacific Century with Misha Oslin, John Yu, Goodfellows with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. I actually moderate that one. And The Libertarian with Richard Epstein and Law Talk with Richard Epstein and John Yu. If you want to subscribe, very easy to do. Go to our website, hoover.org. Click on the menu, go to publications, then go to podcast, and you can subscribe to any or all. You can also sign up for our monthly Pod Blast, which is the best of each month. And I hope that this podcast makes the cut. Joining me today, my guest from New York City, my friend, my colleague, Richard Epstein. Richard, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Richard is the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow here at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at New York University Law School, a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. To say that he is a prolific writer would be an understatement. He is a frequent contributor to Hoover's defining ideas on all sorts of matters. That's another web channel on Hoover you should check out. You might be asking, why is Richard on the show today? Very simple. I was reading these stories about Joe Biden, President Biden, taking meetings with a trio of Democratic historians, Michael Beschloss, John Meacham, who's been writing speeches for Biden since the campaign, and Doris Kearns Goodwin. And Richard, this got me to thinking of you, actually, because you at all times look at the big picture. Also, my friend, you are a product, if you will, of the FDR years. If my research is correct, you came into the world in the third term of the Roosevelt presidency. You would have turned two just a few days after Franklin Roosevelt died. I thought, Richard, we could first talk a little bit about this idea of comparing Biden to FDR, and perhaps we should take a step back and explain to people the enormity of FDR. And I thought you could do it from a personal standpoint, having grown up in New York after his passing, but still him being a very large presence.
Yes, well, I guess my first recollection of FDR was in 1952 during the Adlai Stevenson-Dwight Eisenhower election. Being raised in Brooklyn at that time in a largely Jewish neighborhood, all Republicans were alien species whom you only encountered on strange TV shows. But what was interesting is what the campaign slogan was for Adlai Stevenson. It was following Roosevelt's footsteps. So that is, there was a guy in between who turns out to be a pretty great president himself, Harry S. Truman, who I actually admired at the age of 8 or 9. And he was just simply removed from the equation. So Roosevelt sort of lodged at this huge thing. Now, there were two Roosevelt presidencies, and it wasn't quite clear which of them was the more important for us growing up in Brooklyn at that time. The first, of course, was the New Deal reforms, which took place between 1933 and, you could figure, say, 1940 is a rough date. And then starting in 1940, we start getting ourselves on a wartime footing. And by the time we get to the Atlanta Charter in August of 1941, what we do is we have essentially Roosevelt putting the country into a full-scale war mode. And I have very different evaluations of the two Roosevelts. I think he was transformative in both periods, but I was a rather stout opponent of the New Deal as I came to my intellectual age in my 20s and 30s. But I've always been an unstinting admirer of Roosevelt as a wartime leader. The kinds of egos that he had to deal with, the type of logistical issues that he had to face were really quite something. I think his most unappreciated talent was figuring out the right people for the right job and part of the military war effort. There's a wonderful book called Tuxedo Park, which is about a man named Alfred Loomis, who started off as a great financier and then head of the radiation laboratory that took place in MIT during the war, which was responsible for developing radar, which would allow us to protect the transatlantic traffic from submarines attacks by the German U-boats, right? And, you know, he was something of a genius. And he was appointed by another guy, Vannevar Bush, who widely underappreciated and forgotten today, who was in charge of the overall effort of trying to figure out how you do the science. And these guys were picked out of nowhere by Roosevelt. in one sense or another. The same thing with respect to the productions that he had with people like Henry J. Kaiser and so forth. He's trying to deal with generals, was rather same. Pointing Eisenhower as the commander-in-chief in the European theater was something of a genius, I think, Stroke. At the time, one did not appreciate it. And in fact, the boy growing up in Brooklyn in 1942 did not realize that every single voter in the United States remembers Eisenhower in his famous jacket talking about the Normandy landing, which had taken place only 8 years before. So, yes, I do remember Roosevelt at that time. And, you know, growing up under those circumstances, I think veneration was the appropriate attitude. Later on, as I said, I became much more critical of him on the domestic front, mainly because I became much more of a classical liberal. The development in my case, if you're curious, was not a function of sort of any life-rendering experience. I had a relatively tranquil childhood. I went to a liberal college in Columbia, at that time very heavily Jewish, 1960 to 64, marched over to Oxford for 2 years and back to Yale. It was mainly a function of reading a lot and thinking about these things and becoming something of a contrarian in the course of that intellectual development. And so that's when the stuff with respect to Roosevelt began. And I became essentially, in terms of my own academic mission, is trying to explain why it is that the classical liberal positions of strong property rights and contract rights and limited government with enough to do eminent domain taxation, infrastructure, and the like, is the preferred position. And so I became essentially in opposition to the progressive movement. Now, when Roosevelt did this back in 1932 and 33, it was again a very mixed bag. So his closing the banks and keeping that system stable was, I think, a very powerful movement, because what he was after is one of the great weaknesses of the capitalist system, which is the run on the banks, which start to take place when people lose confidence in their deposit situations. And if you teach a banking course, as I do, you realize that the entire source of the difficulty is a very simple proposition. People who put money in the bank bill, they want it back when they want it. People who borrow the money want to be able to keep it long-term. So if it turns out there's a rush on the demand deposits, you're going to wipe out all of your long-term mortgages, and you need to have some kind of mechanisms to mediate that arrangement. And Roosevelt's bank holiday was a great thing. But on the other hand, this is the same guy who started with the National Industrial Relations Act in 1933 or so, in which he wanted to take over the entire economy, cartelize everything, all right, under the name of dealing with problems of unfair competition. He was struck down in the Schechter case, rightly, still rightly today, and then did this thing piecemeal. And many of his long-term achievements, so-called, in this period, I think, were highly destructive. Motor Vehicle Act, National Labor Relations Act, Civil Aeronautics Act, Agricultural Adjustment Act, because the Roosevelt formula was for cartels, which are the most inefficient form of production. And in fact, cartel members love it, but the rest of the country pays for it. So I have this kind of very mixed view. When Biden comes in, the New Deal reforms have largely survived. He can only take a bad idea and take it further. And on the foreign situation, I don't think he had anything like Roosevelt's international awareness of the geopolitical situation. And so I think on him, I'm probably down on both the domestic and the foreign stage. Well, that's a long answer to a short question, so I'll stop there.
Well, I did a little sleuthing on the numbers here, Richard, and here's what I came out. I compared 1933, the 1932 election, to the 2020 election, the question of what these two gentlemen walk into in terms of power in Washington. So here's some numbers for you to chew on, Richard. Joe Biden wins 51.3% of the popular vote last November. Franklin Roosevelt wins 57.4% of the popular vote in 1932. Joe Biden won 57% of the Electoral College. Richard, do you want to guess what percentage of the Electoral College FDR won?
Well, I know he didn't win everything because that was 36. So he probably won about 85%.
88%. Good guess. Now, you look at Congress, Richard, Joe Biden walks into a 50-50 Senate. I checked on the House numbers last night. Right now, it's 219 to 211 with a few vacancies sitting out here. So it's going to be about 10-seat margin. FDR, conversely, Richard comes into office with 58 Democratic senators, 313 House members. And get this, during the 1930s, during his two terms, Richard, at times the Senate Democrats fluctuated from 60 to 79 seats. This was also the last time one party had over 300 seats in the House. So FDR, well, you can talk about mandate, but you can talk about just a lot of room to play with in Congress, because he's not dealing with a divided House or Senate, is he?
No, I mean, look, now this was very clear. I don't think you mentioned the 1938 election, however, where the Republicans gained a large number of seats in the House and in the Senate, as they did again in 1946. So what happens is, if you actually look at it, the last major pieces of legislation that comes through under the Roosevelt administration were things like the Civil Aeronautics Act in 1938 and the Fair Labor Standards Act in that year, and I think the last of the Agricultural Adjustment Act. After November of 38, everything stops, A, because of the change, and B, because of the looming awareness that the war is there. And the war did basically set everything associated with the New Deal back. Let me just mention a couple of things. One is, there's something known as the National Labor Relations Act, which created the National Labor Relations Board. And that did not operate during World War II. It was a War Labor Relations Board, and it was a system run exclusively by compulsory arbitration, because strikes, which were basically the weapon of choice under the National Labor Relations Act, were forbidden under the War Labor Act. So there were huge concessions to keep the unions in line at that particular period. And then there was also a real awareness during the war that the administrative state had gotten a little bit too large. Even Democrats kind of believed that. There was going to be a reform commission being put in place in 1940 or so. Right. That didn't happen until 1946, when both the labor issue and the national labor and the administrative law issue hit Congress after the Republicans sweep everything in the 46 election. Right. So we get the passage of the Administrative Procedure Act, which is still today the kind of guardian Bible as to how administrative agencies work, at least until we see the Biden administration doing everything it can to circumvent it. Others did so, but not at his level. And also the Taft-Hartley reform of the National Labor Relations Act. And it's important to note the difference. The Administrative Procedure Act, the ADA, was kind of greeted with, basically everybody loved it. And it's a strong thing. Truman vetoed the Taft-Hartley bill, and it was overridden by a combination of Republicans and Southern conservative Democrats, a breed which has completely disappeared today. So, I mean, it was a very, very different political landscape that we had in this country. And after the war, I think the major issues, there was some effort to try to revive stumbling the New Deal, never got very far. People don't remember Harry Truman's Fair Deal because it didn't do very much. But on the other hand, NATO and the internationalist stuff that took place between, say, 1945 and 1955 was extremely important in foreign affairs. It's not just the Korean War. It's the whole situation with the Soviets going on there, the Berlin airlift, the whole thing. That was a prepared. And, you know, Truman, I think, gets very high marks on foreign affairs, which was more important at the time. Not so good mark on domestic affairs, because he was kind of a pale version of Roosevelt without the charm when it came to domestic reform. And of course, Roosevelt had done so much, there was some retrenchment. And now the new civil rights movement bears almost no relationship to the old.
If you're carving a Rushmore, Richard, it sounds like you've got Roosevelt, you have FDR on it. Yes. It sounds like you would put Truman on it. I assume you'd put Reagan on it. Who'd be your fourth?
I mean, post-war presidents of one kind or another?
Post-war and just presidents who didn't make the cut the first time around.
That's an interesting sort of question. I would not put Lyndon Johnson on it, although many people would. Jimmy Carter, I think, is a foregone loser. Bush won, no. Clinton, too slippery for my taste. Right. I would put the second term of George Bush on, but I'm not sure that I would put the first term of him on there. I mean, certainly, I mean, and what about Donald Trump? Look, in terms of significance, he is certainly a very, very important, if much reviled, president by some, but approved by others. He might be there. I guess the fourth one I would say, though, all things considered, would be Eisenhower, right?
Eisenhower, interesting choice.
Because, I mean, he was steady as a president. And, you know, one of the things that he understood is that you could not be frantic. You could not always be in front of the country. And that to some extent, you had to have strategic retreats. So the interesting thing about it is the man who led the battle at Normandy, right? No small endeavor in terms of warfare. He was gun shy. He was not very eager to get himself involved in Europe after the German, East German uprising of 1953, the Hungarian uprising of 1956, the Lebanon War of 1958. The Arab-Israeli War in 1956, he was always on the cautious side of those things. And he was also on the cautious side of getting involved in Vietnam. It was Kennedy who had the heroic vision. I mean, I'm going to give you my favorite history question. What were the two islands that Kennedy swore to defend to the last American life in 1960? Do you remember?
No, go ahead. Tell me.
Huimo and Matsu, if you recall.
Oh, that's
those
right.
Are those two items that were owned by the national...
The Taiwan Strait Crisis.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, why do you have to do this? There was a great piece by a journalist named Henry Fairley, whom I barely remember, in the New York Times when it was a respectable magazine, in which what he did is he went through all the imagined crisis of John F. Kennedy. And he said, the big problem that Kennedy has is this constant heroic vision to go once more into the breach, where in some of these cases, what you really want to do is to get a communique, fold it up, put it aside, wait 24 hours and see if the problem will resolve itself before you, so you get yourself in. And Kennedy, if you recall, was not a great president in that regard. He got completely buffaloed when he went into Cuba in the Bay of Pigs. He was absolutely beaten to a pulp when he met Khrushchev. I guess it was in Vienna, right?
Yes.
He really didn't know what to do that. He only found his step, I guess it's October of 62, when Stevenson showed that he had a background that nobody really ever thought that he had, right? When he faced down the Russians. Were you alive to see that confrontation on television?
Barely.
Yeah, well, I did see it. See, I'm older than you. I'm not saying why, is it just older? But there's Stevenson, you know, this pointy-headed intellectual, nobody thought had the gumption to do anything when he lost to Eisenhower. And he's sitting there and he's approaching the Russian guys and they're hemming and hawing and stalling and stuff. And Stevenson just looks at him, you speak English perfectly well. Answer my question. I mean, right. What he did is at exactly the right moment, he broke the diplomatic protocol and forced them into an embarrassing spot. And he died shortly thereafter, you recall. His years were 1960 to 65. And so, you know, he didn't bask in his glory. But I was very happy about that because remember, growing up in Brooklyn in 1952, this was God. Madly for Adlai was the way we used to describe it on Union Street where I lived.
Yes. So, Richard, next year is the 90th anniversary of Roosevelt winning his first term of the White House. It also means that during this decade, a lot of government programs are going to be having 90 candles on the cake. I could go through the whole list of things from the New Deal that are still hanging around. It's an alphabet soup. FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Yeah. FCIC, the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation. FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, Fannie Mae, you aforementioned Labor Relations Board, Security Exchange Commission, Richard, Social Security and Welfare, the list goes on. Two questions here, Richard. First of all, on this list, there's a Soil Conservation Service. Now, maybe they do God's work, or maybe I'm off base here, but here we are, you know, approaching the 90th anniversary of the Soil Conservation Service, Richard. Why does this institution still prevail nine decades later? Is this a testament to once you create something and once it has commercial protection, it's not going to go away?
I don't know. I mean, let me tell you one story that I do know. The question is, we had this terrible climate crisis in the middle of Roosevelt's administration. We tend to forget about it, which was the Dust Bowl and so forth. And what Roosevelt did is he managed to hire two or three guys as part of a program, two or three guys, right? To tell farmers how to basically organize their land so as to minimize the risk of stuff blowing away. And these guys went around from farm to farm to farm, and they probably generated an overall social wealth, probably 1,000 times what their particular salary was. So that many of the things that Roosevelt did were not particularly grandiose, but they were highly effective. And if the Soil Conservation Bank was the organization that was responsible for telling people how to tilt their land, not to plant on slopes, or to plant on slopes, whatever the thing is, I'm all in favor of that kind of stuff because, I mean, a government agency for very low cost could generate huge benefits. Some of these other situations, well, one of the hard things to do is they all change in midstream. They become amended, their practices start to change and so forth. The FHA, the Federal Housing Authority, is a very different beast today than it was. Fannie and Freddie went through all sorts of multiple convulsions, culminating in the complete mess up that took place in 2008 with the meltdown. But the real tragedy there was the way in which they try to reconstitute it by wiping out all their shareholders. The most famous event there was the so-called Third Amendment or the net worth sweep, which took place in August of 2012, in which the bipartisan efforts of Democrats and Republicans alike managed to wipe out all the shareholders, the junior preferred shareholders that they became and the common shareholder by simply announcing that every bit of money that was free cash inside these corporations would be swept into Treasury. Straight collusive arrangements. I worked very extensively with, amongst others, Ralph Nader, and many other people, recognizing this was the largest grab of corporate wealth in the history of the United States, to no avail. The courts failed us, the administration, both parties failed us. So I think the thing that I would say is, yes, these organizations do endure, but they also transform in many ways, some better, some worse. I mean, federal insurance program for banks, you got to have something like that in place. The question is how it is that you execute it. And one of the things I think that's most important to understand is if you, I mentioned the bank holiday. Mm-hmm. Banking is an industry which cannot work in an unregulated form, given this long-term, short-term stuff. But the difference between your first best and your 10th best alternative is just absolutely huge. And so one of the things that as a classical liberal you have to do is to say, look, everything doesn't have a libertarian market solution. But that doesn't mean, because it doesn't have a market solution, all regulatory solutions are equally good or equally bad. They're vastly different from one to another. And so what you have to do is to start to engage in the kind of design features, what sort of guarantees that you give, what size of deposits you're going to put into this situation. Are you going to allow banks to merge when things get too, you know, too big to fail or too small to fail, whatever it is? Those are the really hard kinds of questions. And what happens is there was a time, I think, earlier on, for the better, when the committees that worked in the Congress were by and large insulated from politics by the chairmen of the various committees. And they wrote technical reports, which were pretty good. I think that started to change in the 1970s and 1980s, where when you were chairman, you told your technical staff, this is my agenda, tell me how to get there. Let's see Wilbur Mills, remember him, the guy who ran the House Revenue Committees or whatever it's called?
The guy also ran into the tidal basin with the Argentinian strippers.
Yes, that's not what he's famous for.
Congressman from Chairman of the Ways.
That's what he is famous for, but that's not what he did.
Chairman of the Ways Committee from
Chairs of Ways and Means Committee. But I mean, you know, you get a technical staff reporting on these rather complicated tax structures. And if you can get good and honest information coming out of these committees, you can do it. And as a teacher of taxation, one of the things I like to do is to point out the many, many statutory fixes that were put into the Internal Revenue Code, which on reflection reversed victories that the government had achieved in various kinds of litigation. Because what happens in litigation is people are very focused on a particular transaction. They see somebody they don't like. They get a ruling which gets this guy, but completely messes up all sorts of other transactions that might be covered by the rule. And then you have to have somebody around who's willing to give up with a government victory and issue revenue rulings, which essentially give you safe harbors for making certain kinds of taxable reorganizations. Now, that's a term which is Greek to you, I suspect, the non-taxable organization, reorganization. There's no reason you should, any sane person should know this, but essentially what happens is corporations constantly recombine and spin off, right? They're very active in markets. And the issue is every time there's a change in corporate structure or control, is this a taxable event for which billions of dollars have to be paid or is it not? And the basic rule of thumb that you want to have is that the only thing that happens in these corporations is you put assets in more efficient pools than they were previously. You don't want to have a tax burden against those things. So you have a tax-free reorganization such that the only thing that can be taxed is cash that's taken out of these businesses and given to individual shareholders, and then only to the extent that it represents gain from certain transactions. And for a very long time, the Internal Revenue Service really followed that kind of position. Well, now you start looking at the tax reforms on the table. They're mad. Yes. The non-recognition, non-realization debate, the Elizabeth Warren debate over wealth tax, these are the most destructive, mindless kinds of reforms that you could ever hope to put into place. And they have a huge amount of political currency because there's absolutely nobody who wants to look at these things on the progressive wing of the Democratic Party as a technical problem of how it is that you deal with both administrative costs on the one hand and liquidity of assets on the other hand. What it is it's simply a question proudly, how we can make 0.05% of the population pay for everything that we want to do. And the net effect of this will be take money out of people who actually know how to invest it, put it in the hands of government people who know how to waste it. And somehow or other, we assume that the shift in control from private to public sectors will increase the overall efficiency of the economy.
This is a good time to segue into what Biden is doing now. So, Richard, the historians told Biden to go big. Now, I assume the historians mean by that do dramatic things in your first 100 days, like FDR. So far, how has Biden gone big? There is a big stimulus package under the guise of COVID. He is now going to give a speech on infrastructure, which is going to be $3-4 trillion more. But here's the question, Richard. A lot of spending of money, but what is Biden doing that strikes you as having the same permanence as FDR? You know, the idea of, you know, somebody digging up this podcast 90 years from now and us talking about Joe Biden initiatives that are still around 90 years later. So is he doing anything really to transform government, Richard, or is this just the shoveling of money?
Well, it's certainly the latter. The question is, is it the former? So take something like the banking reforms of Roosevelt, which in one form or another have lasted a long time. People figured out what was arguably an important structural deficit in the way in which banks were organized and regulated, and they fixed it. Take something like the SEC. I mean, it can certainly go over the top, but the basic argument was that the private provision of defenses against fraud were not sufficiently strong, that having government enforce a traditional common law rule on fraud might be good. It gets overexpanded in some of the cases. But generally, that's a kind of a structural reform that most conservatives could live with. If you recall, the usual way in which this was defended for many years was the United States SEC regulations have made this country the safest place in which to invest because the risk of expropriation by insiders or flimflam artists has been effectively controlled by the regulation. But now that's not what they're after at all in the SEC. What they want to do is to make sure that every corporation spends enough money on climate change control of one kind or another, and to do this by oversight, which I think is a terrible mistake. They're trying to get distributional requirements by race and by gender with respect to boards, which has very little of anything to do with these boards. So I think, in effect, no, there's nothing permanent or useful that's coming in this. And the stimulus programs, by definition, 2 years later, they're gone. Infrastructure. Well, we've always need to do some infrastructure repair. The question is, do we do it well or do we do it badly? And do we do it where we need it or where we don't? And I just have no confidence in this administration because I think there are two really major political determinants and drivers of the situation. One is there's a strong pro-union bias that Biden has, which was not matched by Obama, I think it's fair to say, or even by Clinton. But I think you would agree with that, wouldn't you?
Well, you see Biden getting personally involved. For example, Amazon is having a fight in Alabama over unionization. So Biden has commented on this. He's gotten personally involved in that. That's a stretch for a president.
Yeah, and he always says, you know, I'm in favor of good union jobs. I mean, this is not a guy who keeps it there.
And what percentage of the workforce is union, Richard?
Well, it's public or private. Private is about 6% now, 6.1, 6.2. Right. That's gone down consistently. I do not think it's very easy to revive those numbers because it turns out when you don't have large assembly plants and when you don't have low mobility of labor, unions are extremely difficult to organize. When you have home workers, for example, as we start to do in every number, where do you get to them and how do you get them is going to be an issue. This was, you know, right recently in the Supreme Court just the other day, there was a case on Cedar Point, which did exactly this, saying, you know, the unions want to go onto the shop in order to be able to organize the workers. And everybody says, you got their phone numbers and their home address, send them an email there. Well, the unions say that's more costly for us. And indeed it is. But it's also disruptive. And the Supreme Court's trying to figure out if there's a way to do this particular balance, which I don't think there is, but that's a different story. But all of this long-term union stuff is essentially a way of making sure that the United States does not make needed capital long-term infrastructure. Look, Bill, I mean, there's a very important thing to understand about how you do budgets. Mm-hmm. If you're an ordinary person, you and me, we do our things on cash accounting. And so the way we determine our taxes is we figure how much we take in, how much we pay out, and the difference is a gain or a loss. If you're running a business, you can't do that. Because what you always have to do is to worry about the kind of expenditures that you make today that produce long-term benefits by creating capital assets of some value. Mm-hmm. And so if what you start to do is to just look at gains and losses in the cash flow stuff, if in fact you haven't built up a depreciation replacement fund, you can have all these capital assets going down in value. Your books will show some kind of a positive number, but the underlying economic reality will be negative. So all businesses essentially work on some kind of an accrual system where you tried to take into account changes of value of major assets, even though there's been no sale or other disposition of the particular property in question. And public accounting in the United States government, we do it by deficits, right? Well, think of it this way. If you were to ask yourself, what amount of money was spent on infrastructure improvement in 1960, and what amount was spent in transfer payments? The infrastructure improvement creates an asset. The other things don't. They just transfer wealth back and forth. Well, that ratio has changed dramatically over the last 60 plus years. And there's much, much more which is now spent not on infrastructure improvement, but it is spent on a transfer payment. Then, of course, when you start talking about infrastructure, we used to think of that this is a system of technical bidding. You try to get the most for the least. Now you've got all these set-asides, quotas, special preferences, and so forth. So you treat these as kind of a disguised system for transfer payments as well. The net effect of this is going to be that we will slowly reduce the effective value of the capital because we're not investing enough for the particular for the future. On the business side, things are a little bit better. I mean, my impression, for example, having been in university basically all my life, I ended at 17 and I've never left. So, you know, it's been 60 odd years, is these were small, relatively ramshackle operations back in the 1950s, 60s and 70s. But they are really major, you know, juggernauts in their own right today, which is both good and bad. The good is the management skills that they are able to provide are far greater than anything they have. The bad is their ability to engage in politics to secure transfers and preferences that they probably don't deserve is also increased parallel with their general efficiency. And I don't blame the universities for doing this. I blame having a federal government and the state governments just don't quite understand what the roles of these universities are. And we believe today that the major function of government is to take money from A and to give it to B. That used to be called confiscation. Now it's called politics. And that's a very powerful transformation, to put it mildly. And it's one in the long term that works for the worse. So the thing that I worry most about the Biden type situation is I see a decapitalization of America taking place by an excessive reliance on transfer programs with privileged groups and not enough on real bona fide infrastructure. And so when I want to look through his $1.9 billion or $3 trillion plan, I don't want to just see the gross number. I want to see where it's going to be spent and what it's going to be spent on and how it's going to be done. I'm not a budget analyst, right?
Right.
But you really, I want to see what those guys say. And I want them to be people whom I believe in, who believe that the purpose of long-term government expenditures is to create long-term public assets, not to create transfer payments in disguise.
Right. Richard Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in the op-ed pages of the New York Times the other day. It was a column by a former Democratic senator from Arkansas named Mark Pryor. And what he was writing about, Richard, was the idea of antitrust. Who's going to run the antitrust division in the Justice Department? And he went back and he talked about Robert Jackson, who FDR tasked with going after antitrust. Remember, Richard, FDR runs for re-election.
Simon Arnold.
Yeah,
I think
when FDR runs for re-election in 1936, what is the word? He uses the word royalist.
Yes.
He calls big business royalists, and we're going to go after big business. He's a populist. Here's what Mr. Pryor wrote about, and the whole premise of this is that Pryor thinks that Biden needs to be like FDR and put a bulldog in front of antitrust. And let me read you a passage in this, Richard, and get your thoughts.
I'm frightened already.
Let's see if I can make your libertarian blood boil. Here's what he wrote, quote, "Just as FDR sees the opportunity to reinvigorate and redefine antitrust, Biden is confronting a moment that we may not see for another half century. Dun, dun, dun. The growth and failures of the past 40 years have caused corporate concentration that threatens the foundations of our democracy. Nowhere is this more apparent than with the case of modern-day tech giants, which wield even greater power over our lives than the trust from yesteryear, such as Standard Oil and AT&T. Today's giants permeate our lives, mediating our social relationships and controlling our access to information."
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting, complicated question. Let's go back to Roosevelt, okay?
Yes.
And start there, and you see what the ambiguity is. Roosevelt had the following two propositions. Cartels of my Democratic friends were wonderful. Mm-hmm. Monopolies by my Republican opponents were terrible. Right. And so if you actually look at the New Deal program, they were a cartel machine. One industry after another, agriculture, labor, and so forth, were essentially organized that way. And that cartel is a dumb monopolist. And the reason is cartels have to worry about keeping all their members happy. Monopolists don't have that particular problem. So cartels will deliberately create benefits for inefficient producers to keep them in the game. So to give you an illustration of a classic inefficient cartel, take something like OPEC, right? You want to get everybody in there. Unless you give quotas to the various countries, the inefficient producers are all going to be wiped out and nobody's going to figure out how to make them transfer payment. So you make sure that Venezuela with its dirty oil and so forth gets its fair share. Monopolists don't have that problem. So Roosevelt defended these things because cartels bring boats. And so if you go back to the famous agricultural program, this is the way they work. What you did is you got a national election to figure out what the optimal level of production was for the industry, i.e. the cartel outputting price. And then the Justice Department and the Department of Agriculture were in charge of making the appropriate distributions, first by state, then by county, then by individual farm. Right. So, I mean, it was cartel from the top to the bottom all the way through. When it actually came to industries and so forth, there was complete schizophrenia inside the administration. Right. So one of the great problems that you had was, what do you do with wells that for oil production stuff that may fail and close down? And there are two risks. One, of course, is there's a glut in the market because you get competition, which drives price down. But the other is that these wells will themselves shut down because you don't maintain them properly. And so what the Roosevelt administration first did was to say, we're going to have a buddy system. The big companies are each going to pair up with small companies to make sure that their wells don't silt over and continue to produce. And what happened is that was sanctioned. Then what happens is the Roosevelt administration, under its trust-buster terminology, changes its position. And it says these guys are operating some kind of a cartel. And right. So what they did is they sued them under the antitrust law for company for the very conduct that they asked them to engage in a couple of years before. And in 1940, in a Saccone vacuum case, it turned out that they won. So it was very hard to figure out what was going on in the antitrust under Roosevelt years. And then as you start going through the 50s and 60s, antitrust really takes on a bizarre tone. That is the small merger, Bonds Grocery, and a whole variety of other cases in that period, Brown Shoe, were designed to deal with two small companies getting together to create a third small company. And the antitrust guys were after them. And the great contribution of Bob Bork and his sidekick, my teacher, Ward Bowman, was to try to put a stop of this, which they more or less did. The leading book, I think, was The Antitrust Paradox by Bob Bork, which stressed the importance of controlling horizontal mergers and leaving everything else more or less alone, right? And now when we come back again, it's extremely difficult to know what to figure out about how you start to deal with these tech companies. Look, they are, in many cases, companies that have serious monopoly power. You look at a company like Amazon, it's got over 70% of certain kinds of markets. They can simply delist a book and make sure it's not going to sell very, very much. You get a company like Twitter, which doesn't have huge market power, but in its particular niche, it can silence Donald Trump. And so it goes. So it turns out that there's a real new antitrust paradox. If you look at Amy Klobuchar's bill on the economic side of this, it's pretty terrible. Insofar as what it constantly does is to put presumptions against mergers taking place, even when they seem to have obvious efficiency advantages. And one of the reasons why the European economy is so stagnant is they don't have a very active merger market. The labor unions sitting on these top boards in Germany, for example, make it impossible to have a complicated deal because you know that workers are going to be shed at the bottom and they're not going to stand for that. And so you do that. And at the same time, what you do is you have these congressmen literally getting behind them. Why have you not removed what we affectionately call disinformation, right? I.e. any Republican statement that we haven't did this with is now goes under the name of disinformation. And so you get the government urging them to deplatform guys who disagree with them, which I regard as a genuine menace to free speech. So what is a person supposed to do when he sees that the Congress is in cahoots with the tech industry on an issue where I think they're wrong, and then they're opposed to the tech industry on an issue where they're more wrong than right? The antitrust stuff has become simply another punching bag to take place. What you really are worried about is the control of cartels and monopoly type behavior. There are certainly things that happen. Well, then the question is, what do you do with the monopoly? I don't know that most people are aware of the great debate which takes place between the European side and the American side on this, which was involved in a case called Grinnell. And the American position was, I start a little company, I'll call it Epstein Whaling. And we start with two guys in a backyard, we're like Hewlett Packard. And the two of us are so smart that we build an absolute juggernaut and we get a dominant position in the industry. And the American view was, if you get this by proper pluck, luck, advantage, and foresight. God bless you. You've got this. The thing you have to understand is uneasy lies the head that wears the throne. If it turns out somebody else comes along and they start up with a different gizmo and they topple you, tough luck. You don't get any protection. The European position is somewhat different. They care much less on how you got the power and much more on having the power. So they're willing to basically say that we don't care that it was legit. We want to regulate you and to shut you down. This is not an easy choice to resolve, because if you take the European position, you're not going to get very many big companies. So I'm going to ask you, Bill, a question. How many major innovative companies in tech have taken place in Europe in the last five, in the last, say, 50 years?
I have no idea how many.
I think zero is probably a pretty good number, because the climate is just not suitable for it there. Much heavier systems of regulation up and down the board. And the moment you get big enough, the antitrust types come after you, the regulatory types come after you. And so you don't do it. So you don't see a Microsoft, you don't see an Amazon, you don't see, right? You don't see an Apple starting there. And the great contribution that these countries have to those is when American companies try to do business in Europe, sometimes there's a very strong implicit bias in the enforcement of the antitrust laws. You can be very tough on big companies because you don't produce any yourself. So you might as well try to extract a few rents from the American company. So this landscape is completely roiled. And I really don't know how to do it. I did write something. I don't know if you saw it. I didn't write it really. My friend Tanku Varajan wrote a little piece on the common carrier solution that I proposed with respect to certain of the tech companies with respect to information control. And essentially the argument is, if you are the only outlet in town, you have a duty to deal with people on fair and reasonable terms. That used to be applied to rates. Rates are not the issue that you're facing with Twitter and everybody else. Everything comes at a zero price. So it has to be access. And that would say that if you want to throw somebody off a train, you have to show that they're rowdy.
Right.
To throw somebody off of your website, you have to show that they're engaged in scurrilous falsehoods. And the word disinformation is not it. So for example, you have these various opponents to the administrative position on the question of the vaccines and the HCQ. So the great Barrington Declaration has three very prominent epidemiologists, and you know, they get banned. Like, can't put them out on certain websites because they think that HCQ or other treatments are effective. So now we know what disinformation is. It's disagreeing with Anthony Fauci. Well, that, as far as I'm concerned, is a prime civic duty. I think the man is wrong on everything he's ever said in recent years and so forth. Everybody says, well, he's a doctor, he's a virologist. He doesn't know the first thing about clinical trials or anything else. It's like everybody else. The definitions of expertise are very slippery in these areas, but we don't want to keep these people down. So it used to be called debate, open exchange, and dissent is now called misinformation or disinformation. And we treat it as a species of fraud. And I think, you know, even if these companies don't have monopoly positions, they ought to be really challenged. Defamation suits, attorney general suits. I mean, I'm in favor of doing all of this stuff, but I'm not in favor of saying, well, let's break up Google, as if that's going to produce an efficiency that you could find in the economic markets when these guys are absolutely whizzes at their business.
So that's
there may be practices that they engage in that you want to stop, but practice remedies are much less dramatic than structural remedies. And I just don't see it. So I think there are ways to do with this, but this is not the debate that you're hearing in Washington.
Yeah, you raised a good point, Richard, about government intervening and government perhaps creating a very bad situation. For example, you mentioned Saucony vacuum oil. So that was a case involving price fixing, I believe. The FDR Justice Department also went after Alcoa during the war years, Richard. Yeah. They pursued them along the lines of having a legal market position in the aluminum market. Now, you can go after Alcoa, Richard, and bust up their dominant position. And that makes sense to me. Life is good if I've got five different, you know, aluminum wraps to choose from in the grocery aisle. But let's say you go after Amazon, Richard, and you break up Amazon. Now, I'm old enough to have lived through the Ma Bell breakup, which we survived because why? Out of Ma Bell came what? RBOCs, Regional Bell Operating Companies.
Yes.
And the market went along. So we all survived.
Actually, but not with regional operating companies.
Right. But we survived somehow without Ma Bell. Actually, the system went on.
Oh, yes.
Maybe we survive without Amazon. But and I, full disclosure, I do not own any Amazon stock. I don't work for Amazon. I don't take a penny for Amazon, although I do write for The Washington Post. So technically, maybe I am in Mr. Bezos' employ. But you know what, Richard, in 10 years, we're probably all going to be working for him in 10 years. But
not me.
Anyway, but
I won't be working for anybody.
But with Amazon, Richard, you're busting up something which actually, to me, seems to work pretty well in terms of delivering services to my doorstep reliably, in terms of bringing food if I want. It's a very efficient system. So you may go after it in the spirit of antitrust, Richard, but somebody in the government has to be thinking in the back of their minds, are we about to create a really bad situation for, you know, the average taxpayer out there?
Well, as I said, I'm not in favor of breaking up any of these companies. I do think more surgical remedies would be appropriate. Mm-hmm. So when they start delisting books, right, like Clarence Thomas and so forth, it seems to me a reinstatement remedy is not completely inappropriate. Treating them as though they're kind of like a common carrier that has to tarry all traffic unless you get some very powerful reason. So you may be able to get the Satanists off. I don't think you can get Donald Trump off. So, you know, they say we're going to ban him for life because of what he said before January 6th. I mean, kind of a bit of overkill. That crisis is over. It seems to me that you really have to rethink all of that stuff. And on the business side, what you're talking about here is the neo-Brandeisian movement, about, you know, the curse of bigness and so forth. Yes. If you really want to read a bad book, try reading Brandeis's book on the curse of bigness. It was just a mindless screed. And in fact, as an antitrust lawyer, in many cases, he was much better than that. It's a kind of an interesting situation. So he is famous, at least in my mind, for at least two issues. He was the one who put together the vertical merger in the United Shoe Machinery case, which was one of the great triumphs of industrial design. And he did this when he was in private practice. And then when he was on the court, he wrote a continuing case involving the Chicago Trading Futures Board, whatever it was called, in which he managed to understand how markets work so that something which the antitrust department said was per se illegal, he said was per se legal, and he was right. So, I mean, it was very uneven performance, but the bigness thing then starts to get you into the protection of little competitors from somebody. And so what that means is these are high cost, inefficient operations that you're going to have to go to because you can't buy from Walmart, you can't buy from Amazon and so forth. And even this turns out to be crazy. One of the things that you discover is that if you look at Amazon, every time it enters into a market bill, it doesn't succeed, right? There are certain areas where they're not very good. If you look at nature, I like to think of this as the comparison, the ocean does not consist only of whales, right? They're whales and they're minnows and they're all sorts of fish in between because there's some businesses that you cannot run from the center. So you can't run automobile dealerships from the center. You can't run franchises for McDonald's from the center. The entire franchising industry essentially rests on the assumption that when you have small outlets in diverse neighborhoods, you have to have somebody with a sweat equity in the business to run correctly. And if you try to run these things from McDonald's or Holiday Inns without the franchises, it's going to be a wooden, slow, inefficient kind of operation. So the neo-Brandeisians don't take any of this stuff into question. They also have no coherent merger policy in one way or another. What they want to do is they want to stop mergers on the grounds that what you could do, these little fish would grow into big fish without the merger. But this is the wrong kind of industry. So the basic problem that you're thinking of is this. Google takes over some small company and it turns it into a behemoth. And the Tim Wu school, remember, he's sitting on the Council of Economic Advisors and Lina Khan is going to be nominated for the FCC. These are two appointments that I do not welcome to government because I think they're wrong on everything. So what they then do is they say, well, look, they could have done this themselves. And then we have two competitors. Of course, if you let them go, they don't have the capital. They don't get the advice from anybody else. There's no guarantee that these guys are going to actually be able to do things. I'm certainly in favor of saying that you can grow through an initial public offering without having to deal with a securities transaction like we're talking about. But the dangers here don't lie in the acquisition market. They rely on the securities market. Right now, it's extremely difficult to go public with a new company under the SEC rule. And so in many cases, businesses will incline to sell out rather than to go public because they can't meet it. If you want to do this, the way to fix the balance is to ease up on some of the security restrictions for new firms rather than starting to impose an antitrust restriction. Milton Friedman had a great illustration of this. It's one of my favorites. There's a hole, he said, in the front of the boat. That's like the mistake in the antitrust law. So how do you fix? You know what the answer is if you're a progressive? You put a hole in the back of the boat, so now it's level. So if you see that there's an imbalance between the securities law on the one hand and the antitrust laws, and the antitrust laws are too restrictive, well, what do? You make the security, rather, if the security laws are too restrictive, then you make the antitrust laws too restrictive. No, the thing to do is to deregulate to get parity. It's never to put an additional hole in the boat. And it turns out that all of the Biden New Deal types are essentially big regulators in antitrust and everywhere else. And we will see a serious contraction in the economy. And the people going to take it the hardest, of course, are always those at the bottom of the income scale. Because as these regulations become more difficult, there's going to be a shift away from cheap labor to more expensive labor, and a shift away from cheap labor to machines that can't organize, form unions, get yourself into trouble, and so forth. So let me give you but one other example. You're Jeff Bezos. Now, I'm not a fan of his politics, right? But suppose the guy turns out, what he does is he manages to create 1 million jobs for workers who earn less than $40,000 a year. This is a huge achievement, because these people are probably earning $20,000. And, you know, marginal utility of money, the extra $15,000 means a lot to these people. Then you look at the Securities Commission, they say, well, what we do is the number we care about is the ratio of salary between the top guys in the firm, the top five, and their median worker. Well, this number gets worse, right? Because now you've got all these workers down below. And so it turns out the multiple gets larger. So by doing a good deed with respect to people, you then get a measurement which penalizes you for what people want to do. This is the new movement inside the SEC. As this is not anti-fraud anymore, which is what this ought to be about. This is essentially social engineering by guys who simply don't understand the way in which businesses are organized. And so they penalize people who create opportunities instead of lauding them for doing something that no government could ever do, because they can give them jobs from which they make money. These are not jobs that have to be supported by government subsidies of one kind or another, which impose taxes elsewhere in the economy, which inhibit growth in other kinds of sectors. So, I mean, there's a kind of a real, how do I describe it? Fantasy-like misapprehension of what the antitrust laws are about. And it seems to me that every move that I've seen in the Biden administration is making a serious issue worse.
Yeah. Let's wind down the podcast with this question, Richard. Franklin Roosevelt was 51 years old when he came to office in 1933, fairly young man. He was only 63 years old, I believe, when he passed away.
1945.
Right. Very, very sickly 63-year-old man, if you look at the pictures from Yalta.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, I mean, my goodness. And if you read the stories of his medical conditions in 1944 and 1945, holy smokes, in terms of blood pressure and everything else going on. But, Richard, I would assume in 1933, when he is putting these wheels in motion for government, I assume, Richard, this comes from the top down. This is what the boss wants. This is what the boss believes in. Remember, his neighbors in the Hudson Valley called him that man in Washington, right? Yeah. Just because they didn't like what he was doing. But I would assume that Roosevelt endorsed, believed in everything he was doing. But you look at the Biden administration, Richard, and there's this uncomfortable question at all times of what does Joe Biden believe in? Do you think Joe Biden is a New Dealer, Richard? As we talk about antitrust and we talk about these other measures, which sound like the more they're born from Elizabeth Warren and other people in his party. What do you think Joe Biden actually believes in, Richard?
I don't think Joe Biden knows. I think he's over the top. I mean, he's 78 years old. He's not in good health. You watch him behind one of these monitors, and it's clear that he's constantly grasping for words in one form or another. And so I think he's subject to an enormous amount of influence by those who are in his immediate circle. There's a tendency when people become very weak intellectually, as Biden is, to rely more and more on those people whom they regard as part of their comfort zone instead of anybody else. And there's also, it's easy for somebody to roll them. So if you were to ask me to summarize in a sentence, we voted, many of us, for Joe Biden because we didn't want Bernie Sanders. And what we did was we get Sanders plus. Because there's no question that Bernie Sanders is actually less of a kind of a systematic revisionist than somebody like Liz Warren. I mean, he's not taking the lead on all of these things. She's the one who puts it together. She's the one who finds the Berkeley economists who will say what she wants them to say about the importance of getting income redistribution out of the top into the bottom, why the wealth tax will work and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I think, in fact, that it's a situation where the president is, to some extent, a front man for large numbers of other people. And the thing that you don't like about this bill is you have no idea which of these people are the ones that have the greatest degree of influence. It can vary from day to day and from field to field. But I think that this is a very precarious form of government. On the other hand, if you get Kamala Harris at this point, you'll get much more willful behavior. But she has no governor, i.e. no sense whatsoever of the limits of what government could or should do. And so, I mean, a lot of people like myself are not thrilled with Biden. I think he's a very weak president, but I think she would be a strong but worse president. So let's just hope that he could hang on in this situation and not be too much difference. In retrospect, it's clear to me that the single most disastrous events of the last year or so were the tirades that Donald Trump threw, which threw both Georgia seats, in my judgment, to the Democrats, thereby creating a 50-50 Democratic majority. Biden would be 1/10 as dangerous if the Senate were in Republican hands. And at this point, he is handled by handlers whom we know not. And it's just a question of what kind of rearguard reaction we have. I would predict that the Democrats may well lose the House of Representatives in 2022. I think there's going to be some redistricting by that time, right?
Right.
And it's going to be places like Texas and Florida that are going to gain seats, and California will start to lose them. I think it's possible, though less certain, that he'll lose the Senate. So the next 22 months or so, I think, are a very perilous time for the Republic. And things like the filibuster issue, which is now under constant attack, will turn out to define whether this is a very mediocre administration, or, in my judgment, one which will produce truly catastrophic outcomes in everything that it touches.
Final question for you, Richard, and I sure appreciate your time this morning. You saw Republicans, I thought, caught rather flat-footed over the stimulus debate. There just really was no counter-argument, no good counter-intellectual argument to it. Just kind of steamrolled through, and I can see the same thing happening on infrastructure, which is more complicated because you mentioned this earlier in the podcast. There's a lot of tax policy involved. How do you pay for this? Shakes out. Here's the question to you, my friend. What is the intellectual pushback to infrastructure?
What you have to do is to ask the following question. Are the dollars that you're spending through the public sector and the transfer system more efficiently invested than they are if you spend them through the private sector? And right. The answer is always you have to have some mix of both. And the question is, where does the line go? Mm-hmm. And it's at that particular point that what the Democrats do is just simply shovel things into all sorts of programs. And the idea that they have is if it's infrastructure, it's good, which it cannot be. So what you then have to do is you have to take this line by line to some extent and expose what's going on. The other thing, for example, on some of these bills, a lot of it's just direct block grants for government. And they're very political overtones because we know which governments are likely to get more, those which have more democratic control. And the same thing that is true with respect to the stimulus is going to be true with this. There are also huge issues with respect to the Voting Rights Act, right, which should not be treated as though it's simply an act of voter repression. And in many cases, the kinds of restraints that you're trying to put into place, you need to have a driver's license, not an affidavit, to get on an airplane, right? So why is it we're going to allow same-day registration with affidavits, which could be easily cooked up and so forth? One has to be very serious about the fraud risk. The Republicans, I mean, I have often thought that when they have a principled goal and objective, it's fine. The strength about Trump is on some domestic issues, he actually did have that kind of insight, but on other issues like free trade and immigration, he was often lead-footed and so forth. And if you recall, at the end, he didn't do anybody any good because the populist element in him came out. And all of a sudden, he was pushing for the same size stimulus checks that the Democrats were putting, right? Putting his senatorial candidates in Georgia in an impossible position. So we have a very unhappy situation. The Republican Party at this point, the leadership is basically in Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is a proceduralist, right? He knows how to run his system. He is not a visionary. He doesn't know how to articulate the system that he's pretty good at implementing. Who are the Republican spokesmen? It's very hard to find anybody who kind of stands up above the crowd. Right. And it's going to be, my guess, it will be nobody in Congress who will be the Republican nominee for president in 2024. And the question is, who's it going to be? Nikki Haley? Somebody like that? They need to get somebody who has a voice, because if they are just silent, Democratic dreams and progressive goodwill, endless help will be essentially the order of the day, and Biden will essentially win. And the only question will be whether the rear guard action can control enough of this stuff. We'll see when it starts coming to the judges. His initial points are not initial appointments are not very promising in my judgment. But the interesting thing I think about Biden is he's going slow on that issue. I think he expects that there'll be a lot of problems on confirmation. He's right. Much more interested in the legislative arena. And I think he's probably right about that. And if you go back to Barack Obama, 2009, wasn't it the same thing as I recall? Mm-hmm. Judges come last, politics come first, want to get the ACA through, want to get the American Invents through, you want to get Dodd-Frank through. I think in effect that he made the right judgment, and Biden may be making the right judgment as well. The Republicans banked a lot on the judges, but they're basically a safety guard, a backstop. All the initiation cannot come from judges, particularly Republican judges, many of whom believe in judicial restraint. So I think we're in for a very tough 4 years, and it will get only worse if the Democrats keep both the House and the Senate, even by fragile margins in 2022, because there's no sign here whatsoever for compromise. So the observation that I made is that the era of good feelings lasted between Biden's inaugural address at noon and his first executive order, which took place at 3 p.m., right? After that, it was all one-sided. And I think he's going to continue to rule that way all the way through, which means that a principled Republican voice is strictly imperative if there's to be some kind of sensible balance in the legislative actions and administrative actions that take place in the next 2 years.
Richard, I can't let you go without talking just baseball for a brief moment or two. Can anybody stop the team of your youth, or are the Dodgers destined to win again?
Well, you see, the fundamental misunderstanding. I was raised in Brooklyn amongst Dodger fans.
You're not a Dodgers fan.
I was more of a Yankee fan. I've told
always the contrarian.
it had to do with an incident with a kid named Stevie Munson. I like the Yankee pinstripes. Yeah. I was never anti-Dodger, right? And he said, you have no right to an opinion about baseball because you don't know what a balk is. You see, I was 6 at the time and he was 9. And so it is events like this which shape your preferences. Now I think of this as a benign version of the Civil War. That is, having grown up in Brooklyn and Long Island during that whole period of Dodgy Yankee Giant dominance, I think they're all the same team. I mean, they're wonderful players you like, and some players you didn't like, and so forth. But essentially, it was running it all the way through. So, I mean, Jackie Lott Robinson was a hero in my time, and so forth. And then you had the endless debates. Well, which Hall of Fame center fielder was best? Willie Mays, right? Duke Snider, if you remember him, Dodger, 1926 born.
Some guy named DiMaggio.
Yeah, well, DiMaggio retired in 51. Mantle came up and took his place, right? And so, you know, you get this quadrant. Well, you could argue to your team which is the best and which is the worst of them, but they all belong in the Hall of Fame. Yes. And so that's the kind of thing you want. Then, of course, who was the most underrated defensive center fielder in the history of baseball?
Tell me.
Richie Ashburn,
wow, okay.
Because you go look back, he was the guy who had more putouts than anybody else year after year after year. I think I'm right about that. And if not, somebody will write into you and you will publish an apology on my behalf.
Gotcha. Are you concerned, Richard, that pandemic has been used as an opportunity to mess up the game of baseball? And I'm thinking 7-inning doubleheaders and extra innings, starting with a man on second. And speaking of bad pushes, this push to a clock on pitchers, which I just absolutely cannot stand the thought of. Because beauty to me, Richard, the beauty of baseball, it doesn't have a clock.
Well, that was the beauty. The beauty of baseball was that when I was a kid growing up, a typical game took 2 hours and 10 minutes.
Right.
And now it's at 4 hours. And what happens is you're going to lose your audiences, including myself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you know, this is like fixing the antitrust laws bill. Right? Yes. Once you mess it up, it's really hard to figure out how you put it back together again and so forth. 7-inning games, you know, in college baseball, when they have doubleheaders, it's 9 in the first and 7 in the second.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not, that doesn't fundamentally change the game. The real changes on the field are skewed defenses, because you now actually understand that pulling a ball is a huge advantage for the hitter. And so you have to have the defense that matches it. Changing pitchers, right? You remember Robin Roberts? Well, you don't remember Robin Roberts. 1950 to 1955, you know, the guy would complete 25, 30 games a year throughout his arm and was not heard from again, except as a knuckleball or a slow ball pitcher of one kind or another. Today you got 12 and 13 pitchers on a team, right? And you got guys who specialize in the eighth inning, ninth inning, fourth and fifth inning, and so forth, because everybody knows from the statistics that the third time through the lineup, the batters essentially now are in their groove. They figured this guy out, and his pitches are down 3 or 4 miles an hour. That doesn't sound like much, does it? Well, it turns out it's a couple of feet on the ball.
Exactly.
So in the early innings, he was swinging when the ball was in the catcher's mitt. Then in the later innings, you're just meeting it head on. So, I mean, those are the things there. But I agree with you. You have to be very careful about rules changes of one form or another. The one that I like is, no, you can't go to the mound to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And so forth. I'm not so upset about the pitch clock. But remember, you're probably right. It won't work. It didn't work in golf, right?
No, it doesn't work. It bothers me, Richard, because the idea you're going to have something that blinks 20, 19, 18, 17.
Yeah, no, you don't want it. That's very bad. Richard on the other hand, it saved basketball.
Yeah. Richard Epstein releases the ball. Maybe the ball's on Richard Epstein's fingertips as the clock goes to zero. We're going to have to go to replay. So we're going to spend 5 minutes seeing whether or not Richard Epstein's fingertip is on the ball. You're going to just slow down the game.
Well, I'm not for that. On the other hand, are you against the 24-second clock in basketball?
No, I'm not. So for the pros, it's okay. I mean, pro basketball is a pickup game basically anyway, so it doesn't bother me. The colleges, I'd like to see them maybe push the clock back a little bit, because holding the ball is a strategy. It forces teams to adjust.
A little bit. I think, what's it now, 35 seconds?
I think it's 35 seconds. That seems to work okay.
I'm not against that. The four corners offense was death. I could still remember the Boston Celtics with Bob Cousy going into the freeze with 6 minutes to go in a game.
Yes.
And the home team would get after him. He was such a good dribbler. The only way he could get it would be to foul him. I think that those changes were there. You know, look, there are three major changes in basketball, and we could end on this, all of which I think helped save the game. One is the key no longer looks like a key, right? Because it's not 6 feet anymore. It's now 16, I think it is, right?
Right.
And then the 3 second line. The three-point line, rather, changes the game for the better, I think, and the clock.
Right.
I mean, pro basketball does not seem to be suffering from a structure of rules. Soccer is the game for which the rules are crazy.
Yes.
I mean, that's another show if you want to do it. They need to go to hockey-type rules. If there's a penalty, you don't just put the ball down. You take a player off for 3 minutes. So you create scoring opportunities by having asymmetrical numbers. Both guys go off 10 on 10, probably the probability of scoring versus 11 on 11 probably increases by 15 to 20% of the guess.
Okay. Right?
Because those open spaces essentially always favor the offense. So there are a lot of things that you could do in a lot of games, but that's a different show.
Well,
and it doesn't have much to do with the Biden administration.
No, we'll find a hook somehow, Richard. Don't worry about that.
Okay, I'm not worried.
Hey, Richard, I enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure to be with you. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And if you wouldn't mind, spread the word. Tell your friends all about us. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That's @HooverInst. Richard Epstein, brave man that he is on Twitter as well. His Twitter handle is @RichardAEpstein. Epstein spelled, as you might imagine, E-P-S-T-E-I-N, Richard A. Epstein. I mentioned our website beginning of this broadcast, and that is www.hoover.org. While you're there, I'm going to ask you to do one more thing. Sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Richard Epstein and his colleagues to your inbox weekdays. And to sign up for that, could be simpler. Go to the Publications tab, click on Hoover Publications, click on Daily Report, and there you are. You can also click on the Defining Ideas tab where you'll find Richard Epstein's brilliant work. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.